This afternoon, we're going to be reviewing for the lab exam again. And for those of you who are not present during the lecture as it was presented, I am going to be referring almost entirely to the already posted notes. And so if there is nothing posted in terms of written notes for today, that's intentional. I'll be going through every day of the lab that we had to again identify topics that are on the lab exam and topics that are not on the lab exam. So beginning at the top, April 15th, molar volume of an ideal gas at STP. We began with a discussion of redox only because this is the first chemistry I think that the class had really talked about. No, you had one lecture day because the lab, the first day, we went over the syllabus. So anyways, the point is, this is the first thing we did in lab. So the redox reaction doesn't really matter. It's what's at the bottom of this first page, which is identifying the limiting reagent. Magnesium, the strip of metal that's bobbing around in a solution of hydrochloric acid. There's plenty of hydrochloric acid, so it's the excess agent. And so magnesium is the limiting reagent. Now, it's a small detail that I won't ask about. In real life, if we had been in lab, the magnesium would need to be processed first because it grows this layer of magnesium oxide on the outside. Not going to ask about it because we didn't physically do it. Ideal gases. That is a lecture topic to understand what the characteristics of an ideal gas are. But it's what's on the next page that matters, that hydrogen is a good gas to use for this experiment because it acts very much like an ideal gas. And the two specific reasons I stated were its small molecular size and its low intermolecular forces. STP, what STP is a lecture topic. But this PV over T equals PV over T equation, that is something that showed up in the calculations, which I discussed more in depth on a different day, but we'll get there momentarily, therefore. So the last page has a drawing of the setup that would have been used. You have this tube, the eudiometer, that's turned upside down in a container. You have hydrochloric acid that was at the bottom of the eudiometer tube, which now becomes the top once it's turned upside down. The hydrochloric acid floats down to the bottom, reacts with magnesium, generates bubbles, and that's hydrogen gas that you then collect. This page has the most important thing as far as calculations for those of you who didn't understand the calculations for this lab. The highlighted equation in the middle of the page shows how to properly calculate the pressure of hydrogen gas. And that's because, unlike the text, this calculation takes into account the effect of what happens if water is trapped inside the level of the surrounding container, if there's water trapped inside that eudiometer. Because that water is effectively weighing down on the surface, fighting against the external pressure. So that means that if we're calculating total pressure, we're adding the contribution to that height as part of that total pressure. So rearranging the equation, H2, you still have to worry about that height difference. If you actually have a height difference that results in your experiment. And in the lab report, when I gave you the data, one set of data did not have a height difference, but one set of data did. So you had to use this equation, not the one that was in your text. Now, to get the height, that I discussed on the next day of notes. So let me get rid of this extra page really quickly here. So moving to the next day's notes, April 20th, the beginning of that discussion was going more in depth about the height difference because I knew that would be something that would confuse people. So I again mentioned the total equation being based on this height difference, the pressure of hydrogen gas itself, and hadn't mentioned it yet, but this vapor pressure of water. Vapor pressure is automatically present. You're not going to be asked a question, why does vapor pressure happen? That's a lecture thing. That's because a fraction of molecules at any temperature have enough energy to be able to evaporate. No, here I'm just going to focus on the calculations. So the rest of this page discusses how to handle the height difference, as well as this next page. Now, the bottom of the next page gets to the PV over T equals PV over T equation. And what that's about is adjusting the gas conditions from what we really used in the lab to STP conditions. So on the left, we have either quantities we directly measured, like the temperature, or you have things that we calculated, like the pressure. And then you have STP conditions on the right. And you're solving for volume, which is therefore adjusted to be for STP conditions. And so then after that, there's only one calculation left, which is to come up with the molar volume. In other words, divide by the number of moles we actually used to find out what the volume of one mole would be. The rest of this day's lecture was lecture material. It was about intermolecular forces, and so it is not on the lab exam. So the next lab day was April 22nd. The first portion of that lab's discussion is lecture related, because it was defining vapor pressure and talking about the relationship between vapor pressure and boiling point. Not something I'm going to directly ask about. Not even the next page. The next page, in fact, was our first introduction to one of the ways of thinking about equilibrium. Equilibrium as a topic is a lecture topic, not on the lab exam. The next page is related to the lab exam, because I show a simplified setup of what this experiment would look like. Highly simplified, because the valve is somewhat attached to the unit itself, and then you have this pressure gauge you would be using. But to just look at the picture and just describe it, you start out with an Erlenmeyer that you put a stopper on that does have these two attachments on it, pressure gauge and a valve. The valve you open up to expose the container to outside atmosphere to let the two equilibrate. You then close off the valve in order to maintain the environment of the container. And then, in a way to try to not affect the pressure, you add ethanol to the container, which is going to evaporate, generate its vapor pressure. So, in the calculations, which I'll show later on, which I think happened in lecture. I think I forgot to show that page. I'll have to go double check here as we flip through. You have the pressure of the total air, but you only care about the pressure of the ethanol that's in there. And so you can take the pressure of the air, adjust it for whatever temperature you change to, subtract that out, and you get the ethanol pressure. Now the rest of this day's discussion is not going to be on the lab exam, because it's about generating that graph. Well, okay, let me be a little bit more careful what I say. You're not going to be given a set of data to do these calculations to come up with the graph. But I could ask about what's written at the bottom of the page there, the purpose of making the graph, which is that if you did plot log of vapor pressure on one axis and 1 over temperature on the other, you're going to end up with the heat of vaporization. So that small portion of it you need to know. The rest of that day's notes was about ethanol, which, although an interesting subject, is not going to be on the lab exam. So that leads us to the 27th. Which I again started out reminding us, here are those calculations I want. So we started out with the graph again, that you're not going to have to worry about how to do, except why we did it. But then the next page gets into the calculations themselves. So as you can see in the middle of the page, there's an equation there that says that the total air pressure inside the flask, that's a bad phrase, the total pressure inside the flask is equal to the pressure of the plain air, what was originally trapped in there, and the ethanol that's generated the vapor pressure once ethanol is physically added to the flask. So we have to solve for just the pressure of ethanol itself. In order to do that, we have to calculate what the pressure of air is at the temperature that we did the measurement at. because in this experiment, you would have heated up the mixture a little bit at a time and done multiple measurements at different temperatures. So every temperature, when we need to calculate the vapor pressure of ethanol, we have to adjust and calculate what truly would be the contribution of just that plain air that was around. And that's the portion of the calculations that matters. So we've effectively gotten up through the first two experiments. Does anyone have any questions so far? Okay.
I didn't quite understand the adjustment of temperature part. Like, what do we need to do there?
I'm sorry, do where?
Where you say adjustment of temperature in the calculations?
Well, because when you trap the air in the container, you did it at a particular temperature. So let's say, for argument's sake, that you started out at one atmosphere, 760 torr. You then, in real life, would have raised the temperature by, I forget if it's 5 or 10 degrees, 3 degrees, whatever it is, in order to see what would the effect of vapor pressure be. That's what the graph is going to show us. But in order to get that vapor pressure, we have to subtract out whatever the air alone is. And that pressure doesn't stay constant. It changes with temperature. So that's why it says adjusted for temperature. The equation down below shows you how to calculate the effective true pressure of air based on the temperature that you're at. Okay, so moving to the next notes. Spectroscopy. Yes, there's going to be something related to spectroscopy, but it's not going to be to some of the detail that I presented here. Like what a frequency and an amplitude is, not going to really ask about. What is electromagnetic radiation? That's really more of a Chem 1A question. Bottom of the first page, though, about photons. You do need to know what a photon is, and then a photon has to have the right energy in order for it to be absorbed. So talking of energy, I wanted to at least have the discussion of energy levels, which is why I brought up atomic spectra. But no, you're not going to be having questions about atomic spectra, because again, that's a 1A topic. Same thing like the EM spectrum, no. But spectroscopy as a technique, yes. So knowing that light passes through a sample, interacts with that sample, some of it gets absorbed, that the photons are the right energies, and you can tell that when the light comes out of the sample and hits the detector. So two ways of measuring that are transmittance and absorbance, and we use absorbance in our calculations because it happens to have a linear relationship to concentration. The rest of this set of notes was answers to a quiz, I believe. So we're going to move on to May 4th, which is all about orbitals, which means none of that is on the lab exam. And then the next day was sig figs, not on the lab exam. Green crystal, most of it not on the lab exam. The part that is going to be on the lab exam is the redox titration, which is on page 6 of the May 6th notes. So the other portions where you synthesize it, not on the lab exam, especially the recrystallization. That's something I really feel like you need to see before I ask questions about. So only the oxalate titration, and there's a couple of things I would focus on. One is what is being analyzed. And it's the permanganate, not the permanganate. You're using permanganate to analyze oxalate. Why? Because permanganate and the oxalate will destroy each other. Permanganate has a very distinctive purple color. So if you add enough permanganate where there's no more oxalate left, then you're going to have a color change. So that color change then tells you you have reached the point where the reaction's done. Visually, that point is called the end point. Mathematically, that point is called the equivalence point. Equivalence point is when equal moles, taking into account stoichiometry, have reacted. So in other words, at the equivalence point, 2 moles of permanganate will have reacted with 5 moles of oxalate. But the end point is not that exact same thing. It's usually just past it. Because like I said, the only way that you're going to get excess permanganate is if you already reacted everything else, which means you have to be one little tiny bit beyond the equivalence point in order to have a color change. So in the notes for Monday, when I went over the topics for lab lecture, I mentioned endpoint versus equivalence point, and that's what I mean, that I want you to understand this distinction between the two concepts. All right, so that leads us to the May 11th notes, which, again, the most of this is not a lab exam, although on page 2 of those lab notes, that is one of the times I did talk about spectroscopy. So I talked about it, again, about how spectroscopy occurs, and I talked about this lambda max, the wavelength of maximum absorbance. So although the specific place where this is mentioned is not in your lab exam, the concept of Beer's law and wavelength of maximum absorbance, those could or would be on the lab exam. So there is Beer's law, one of the first times we talked about it. So again, this probably talks about iron being detected, but just change the language to an equilibrium complex. And that's the same Beer's law that we use in the equilibrium lab. Hydrate analysis, that's something you did in 1A, so I'm not going to ask about it again. That brings us to the 18th, which is all kinetics, but lecture kinetics, so nothing from that set of notes. The 20th, also lecture material, all about bonding and delocalization, or also it looks like some quiz and test answers, so nothing from that day. 27th, that's the important day of the kinetics lab. In the kinetics lab, no, you're not going to likely have to do any real calculations because you're already spending enough time trying to do them for your lab reports. It's really just the theory I care about, which the part of the theory that I really care about is what starts on page 3, which is why are there 3 different reactions? And recall, the first reaction is the one we're studying the rate law for. The second one controls how far the reaction goes before it starts changing color. Because the triiodide that's formed gets eaten up by the thiosulfate. And until all the thiosulfate's gone, no color change can occur. So that's why I say thiosulfate establishes the extent of reaction. And then we have this reaction that's just there to turn thing color so that we can see what's going on. Why we have the 3 reactions, that would be important. Which means most of the rest of this set of notes is not relevant to the lab exam. So that was the 27th. Wow, we already got up to there. So that means the 1st of June. Which, again, it deals with calculations for the kinetics lab, which, of course, you need to know for your lab report, but not going to be on the lab exam. So that whole day's set of notes, you can ignore.
Professor, I have a quick question.
Yes.
For the lab exam, will it be similar of a format to like our regular exam?
Yes.
Okay. And you will be posting this certain meeting.
Oh yes.
Recording and everything, because I just need it. You're going a little fast, so I need to study all the things that you're saying.
Yes, and Like I said, although I'm not writing it down, I am, as you can see by watching it, going page by page through the notes. So you'll have this audio afterwards, yes.
Okay, excellent.
All right.
Thanks, Professor.
Sure. And let's see. So that brings us up to the third, which was all quiz or exam answers. That brings us up to the eighth, which is the first part is going to be the lab quiz because it's about the equilibrium constant lab. So that's where I went over Hess's law again. Not Hess's law, what did I say? Beer's law. And it's a problem where, in terms of an ice calculation, where you're usually having to solve for X, in this case, you're going to have X because that's the concentration of this iron complex that forms. So knowing how the substance behaves, the complex that's the product, we're able to use Beer's law to get its concentration. Again, like I said, that concentration is like X in a standard ice problem, as you can see here on the last page. Now, in order to come up with the equilibrium constant, we do need to know the initial concentrations of the reagents, which is why there are these dilution equations at the bottom of page 3. But then once you do come up with the equilibrium concentrations, initial concentrations, the ice table itself is fairly straightforward because we've seen it several times this quarter, things with a 1:1:1 stoichiometry. And we don't need to simplify for X because we already have it. So you just have to fill all the numbers in, calculate, and you can solve for X. All right, that is the last lab that's on the lab exam. Because indicators, that was a topic I wanted to cover, but we didn't do the lab report for it, and I said that it wouldn't be on the lab exam. The same thing on the 10th, that was all about the calculations for the third experiment report, which is the kinetics report, or we were talking more about the indicators. So that gets us almost there, because... that is it, because the very next set of notes from the 15 is the list of topics that would potentially be on the lab exam.